Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West and, hey, more West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 342 of Registry Matters. Larry, good evening. How are you tonight?
Doing awesome. Now, just how far west are we going tonight? So we're west and more west. How far west?
We are going all the way to the west before you hit the Pacific.
What would the geographic location be to orient me and the audience? Where would we be going?
I'm going to just guess it's the tallest state.
The tallest state. Huh, could that be?
I believe so. I'm not positive. I mean, is Alaska taller?
The tallest
state. And do they actually even count?
No.
I think that would be Hawaii, no. The tallest state, right?
What?
No.
Okay. I don't think so.
I'm pretty sure we're talking about California.
No, I would say Delaware is much taller than California.
Oh, Jesus. Really? You're going to go there?
Yep.
Hey, I have to tell you, like, I know we always like banter about the weather and whatnot, but ridiculous. This morning, my heater turned on. It's almost June.
Really?
Yes, I'm really irritated by this. It is dumb cold.
Wow.
We'll trade you. It's 90 degrees here, 87 now.
But... I will trade you too.
This is 75 over here.
Larry, do we have anybody joining us tonight? I know we keep hearing it in the background, but should we reintroduce?
Yes. Well, let's just go ahead. I'll tell you what we're going to be doing. It's a holiday weekend, so we're planning on keeping it a bit light. And we have Chance Oberstein back with us after several weeks of absence. And he's graciously prepared a segment on habeas corpus, and we have a few articles to cover. We might even go back to the plea bargain discussion we had on episode 338 because an angry listener told me that I didn't do a thorough enough job explaining why federal court is so difficult. And Chance can probably add more to what I said, and since he practices in federal court on that segment. And also, Chance, glad to have you back. If you want to tell us a little bit about your hiatus, or if you want to just move forward from here, either way, it's good.
Well, it was a nice hiatus, although I was very busy. I'm working on a new podcast called Sex Crimes Defense, and trying to complete a book and doing some photography and, you know, this and that type of thing. But it's very nice to be back.
Well, glad to have you. We've been doing a few different things since you've been gone. We've been creating a lot of shorts, as they're called. And I don't know enough about them other than they seem to be getting a lot of traction in terms of the number of views. It goes into hundreds and sometimes over 1,000 views on YouTube for the shorts. So.
Oh, that's excellent.
And I understand Andy spends all weekend preparing those shorts to be released all through the following week.
Absolutely the truth.
Wow.
So
let's move along, huh?
I was going to say, what are we going to be doing with Chance tonight? I think his segment is first.
It is. We're going to be diving into one of the most important and often misunderstood legal concepts called habeas corpus. And back with us, as we've already said, is Chance Oberstein, and he's an attorney in California. Good to have you back, Chance.
Oh, thank you for having me, Andy. Appreciate that. You know, habeas corpus is one of the most powerful and historically significant legal principles I can think of. It's been in the news. It's out there. Everybody's hearing about it all the time. And I'm excited to unpack its meaning and its importance today.
So let's start with the basics. What exactly is habeas? Like one of my first roommates when I was down, he was working all kinds of stuff with habeas corpus. Why is it such a cornerstone of justice?
Well, I mean, let's take it from just the name, habeas corpus, Latin for "you shall have the body," is the legal writ that requires authorities to justify an individual's detention before a court. If the detention is found unlawful, the court orders their release. So the importance of it is it prevents governments from arbitrarily imprisoning people without cause and ensures that due process, ooh, a weird concept, fairness, is followed.
So essentially, it's a check against unlawful imprisonment. In other words, if you're locked in a dungeon and they won't tell you why you're there, you will file this thingy called habeas, and it's an invitation for a judge to examine your detention.
That's exactly right. I mean, habeas corpus ensures that legal processes are upheld. When someone is detained, their custodian, typically law enforcement or a corrections facility, must present them before a judge and provide a legitimate legal basis for their detention. If the detention lacks merit, the individual must be released.
Well, I know that since I work in the legal profession, I'm somewhat familiar. I've actually helped file habeas and done my own, but the principle goes back historically a long time. Can you walk us through that so people understand how significant habeas is?
Sure, absolutely. Habeas corpus dates back to English common law, first codified in the Magna Carta of 1215, believe it or not. And the Magna Carta was a groundbreaking document that limited the monarchies, meaning the king's power, and provided certain legal protections. And we're talking England. By the 17th century, habeas corpus was firmly established in England as a tool to prevent unlawful imprisonment by none other than the crown.
And how did habeas corpus make its way into the U.S. legal system? It seems like a long way and a long time.
Oh, it traveled far, but the short answer is that it was inserted into the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution explicitly recognizes habeas corpus in Article 1, Section 9, stating that it can be suspended in cases of rebellion or invasion when public safety requires it. The Founding Fathers understood its importance in democratic governance, ensuring that individual freedoms remain protected from government overreach.
Well, that brings us to a critical question. Why does habeas corpus matter in modern legal systems such as ours today? I mean, we're past all that. No one would incarcerate someone without a valid reason in the United States of America now, would they?
Well, no. Now, would they? Of course they would. And this is why it's so relevant today, because it's happening. And it matters for several reasons. First of all, it safeguards individual liberty. No person should be deprived of their freedom without just cause. Habeas corpus allows individuals to challenge wrongful detentions. It promotes government accountability. It requires authorities to justify detentions before the court, ensuring legal transparency. Is this starting to sound familiar? It also protects against arbitrary government actions. In times of political unrest, habeas corpus serves as a safeguard against mass detentions and abuse of power.
Would you do something, and can you give us something of a real-world example of habeas corpus in action?
Well, I can tell you that the current executive administration's totally overriding it. That's a good example, but absolutely. Imagine an individual is detained without formal charges, like someone who's alleged to be a gang member. Through a habeas corpus petition, they can force the government to justify their imprisonment in court. If no legal grounds exist, they must be released. So you just can't grab them, send them away without any kind of hearing, and leave them where you drop them.
Well, that leads us to the question that people are not familiar with, how it works in practice. What is the process? So you're in the dungeon, and you haven't been given that one phone call that you've all heard about growing up watching TV. What happens next?
Okay, so you're nabbed in Maine and you're transferred to Louisiana. The first thing that happens is the filing of the petition. The detained individual or someone acting on their behalf, like an attorney, files a petition in the appropriate court stating the grounds for believing the detention is unlawful. Then there's an issuance of the writ. If the court finds merit in the petition, it orders the custodian to present the detainee before the court. Then, of course, comes the court hearing. Authorities must justify the detention with valid legal reasoning. I underline that. This is the whole due process part of it. Authorities must justify the detention with valid legal reasoning. Then a judge must decide. There must be a judicial decision. The court decides whether the detention is lawful. If it isn't, the detainee is released immediately.
Released immediately. So I'm picturing this thing where a person walks into court. There's actually not walked in their own power. They were dragged in because they're in custody. And they put on their case. And the judge says, nope, no lawful authority. Release them. They get to walk out right then. Are there exceptions to habeas corpus?
Oh, yes. There's always exceptions. You know, although habeas corpus is a fundamental right, it's not absolute. Some exceptions include suspension during emergencies. Governments may suspend habeas corpus in cases of rebellion or invasion for public safety reasons. For example, in the 1800s, President Lincoln controversially, I might add, suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War to suppress unrest. Military detentions also. Combatants captured in active war zones may be detained without the same habeas corpus protections, and of course there's statutory restrictions. Some laws impose restrictions like limits on successive petitions or deadlines for filing.
Now you do remember that I was the Deputy Secretary of War for President Lincoln, right?
About, yeah, roughly a little over 100 years ago, yes.
Yes, I sat in on those discussions and it was very controversial, and the president had a lot of trouble trying to convince people to go along with that. But ultimately, his charisma prevailed. But there have been major legal battles over habeas corpus. Can you think of some landmark cases that someone might recognize, or at least we can talk about?
Well, historically, three major cases come to mind when you say that. Ex parte Milligan, 1866, the Supreme Court ruled that civilians could not be tried in military courts if civil courts were operational, reinforcing habeas corpus protections during wartime. Then there's Rasul v. Bush, 2004. The case marked the first time foreign nationals held at Guantanamo Bay could invoke habeas corpus rights. And then there is Bomadine versus Bush, 2008, which is something that's interesting. The Supreme Court held that Guantanamo Bay detainees had the constitutional right to challenge their detention during habeas corpus.
Now, I'm going to go off script because I'm not familiar with those cases. At least they don't come to mind. But so we're determining, or at least the courts determine, not we are determining, the courts determine that even though you were not on official U.S. soil, but you're on an occupied strip of land that's in controversy, that since the United States government put these detainees there, they were still entitled to habeas access to American courts through habeas corpus. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, and they would be considered, I think, in terms of, you know, how we would put them in the proper context of detention, terrorists, combatants, sitting on foreign soil.
So, yeah, because that is highly disputed territory in Guantanamo. The Cubans have tried to invite us to leave, but we've refused. And so that's clearly not U.S. soil, according to Cuba. But yet they have right to habeas.
Correct. And
I wonder, this is going well, Scrip, I wonder if that was their thought process when they shipped them to Guantanamo, thinking that they would be outside the jurisdiction of U.S. boundaries.
Now, you know, that's a good question, and I wonder if that was the whole point of it, is so that, you know, those types of rights would be suspended, and they could be held there without question. So.
And I would also, they were not citizens. I don't think you said that along the way. A terrorist can be a U.S. citizen, but in this case, I don't think any of them were U.S. citizens.
I don't think so. I don't think they were.
So, yeah, they were snatched off of the foreign battlefields or foreign nations and brought to the U.S. And it's funny what we would think if our citizens were taken to a foreign nation. People will remind me that they're terrorists, but that those are accusations that were not proven out, you know, through a robust adversarial process. But how would we feel? I'll just pose the question: if a foreign power had enough resources to come in and grab people and take them to another country and put them in custody, and then American president leadership would be stable. Have they been charged with anything? Well, no, they ain't been charged with nothing. Why you hold them? Well, because they're terrorists. What'd they do? Well, we can't tell you that. It's national security. It would reveal our secrets. Well, are you going to take them before a judge? No, they don't have any right to see a judge. How long are they going to be? Well, we don't know that. Mm-hmm. We're going to keep them. How long are you going to keep them? Well, we haven't determined. Can you imagine how we would react?
Well, I'm trying to, because it's happening right now. And the whole point of this discussion, at least for me, is, you know, if you allow this to happen in that context, and there's no national security interest to it, there's no invasion, there's no justifiable reason for doing it other than you think that that's what the voters want you to do, how long does it take to extend into other places in our society?
So,
how long does it take to target other groups and to start doing the same thing? Once it becomes acceptable, you lose it. You lose the right. Then simply, you know, we're working on affidavits and due process is out the window and we're living in another place.
So, well, I hear people say that all the time. Well, they're not citizens. They don't have any rights. I said, well, wait a minute. If you were in France, how would you like it if they told you you have absolutely no rights because you're not a citizen of France? And they always look at me and their head roll, eyeballs roll the back of their head, and they don't know how to answer that because I'm truly asking a serious question. If you were told, if you got detained in a foreign nation, you have no rights because you're not a citizen of this nation, how would you react? So,
don't you guys remember?
So it's a good question.
God, maybe it was 10 years ago. There was a young lady that was in France. It's funny that you bring that up, Larry, that she was having a relationship with another couple, I think, and something really went bad. I think somebody may have been murdered, and she was on trial in France, and she's not a citizen, but they're trying her under France law. So isn't that what we're saying here, that if they're here, they should be tried under, and have the same rights and guarantees and be tried under our laws here, citizen or not?
Well, that's my position. I don't know if that's the way it's ultimately going to be. But I think anybody who's in the country, whether here legally or illegally, if charges are levied against them, they have to be given the process that anybody else would be given because they're here.
That's
but anyway,
correct.
But before we wrap up, unless you got more chance, let's talk a little bit about why it's habeas corpus remains so relevant today.
Oh, okay. Well, in today's world, as we're just discussing, habeas corpus is central to addressing legal challenges such as mass incarceration. It ensures individuals are not wrongfully detained in overcrowded justice systems or for national security. Habeas corpus remains crucial in counterterrorism efforts, ensuring rights aren't violated. Immigration detention. Non-citizens, as we were just discussing, can challenge unlawful immigration detentions through habeas corpus petitions and a whole host of things we can't even imagine at the moment, but will soon be revealed to us on day by day for here on out. So we're going to see a lot of this issue, a lot of it, and it's going to come down to not just the idea of habeas corpus, but the idea of due process, fairness in the system in addressing these things.
Well, due process is a very expensive thing. It's inconvenient. We have to transport prisoners so that they can confront the people who, you know, that are accusing them. We have to provide representation because the constitutional guarantee of due process is irrelevant if you're not adequately represented. All these things cost money. But ultimately, that's the price you pay for living in a free society where the big, mean, uniformed people can't knock at the door at 2 o'clock in the morning and come bursting through the door and take you away. These are the things that protect us. Due process is very important, but it's been a great overview and a good discussion. And you know, we've barely touched the surface of habeas corpus, but just out of curiosity, do you, in your practice, do you provide the service if a person contacts you post-conviction and they want to file a habeas? Do you do that type of work?
I do, well, actually. I do.
Well, how would they contact you? I guess your number is displayed at some point, but yes.
Numbers displayed. People write me. A lot of folks who are interested in this type of thing are in custody. So, but I do hear from their lawyers. I hear from paralegals. I get mail. Yes, I do handle these things. And I handle them and I because I look out and I, and, you know, my perception is, you know, yes, they're a pain and they're intense and they're expensive and, you know, you can never charge enough to do one of these things. But, you know, when I look at the way Russia handles things, people are camouflaged, their faces are covered, they pull people off the street. And then I look at what's going on here and I see a mirror image of what's happening there. It compels me to be interested in this type of thing and do this type of work.
Nope, other than I could go down a whole bunch of rabbit trails of detours and whatnot about what happens if we don't follow what's in the Constitution. And you just say, be damned, we'll just take it to court and see what happens later. But that would send us down a whole nother podcast episode if we did that.
Be a great episode.
Because the judicial branch doesn't have any sort of enforcement powers, as far as I understand it. They don't have like the Supreme Court Justice Armed Forces or something like that.
Well, you know, not everything's done, you know, with the promise of force behind you. And, you know, the other thing is that our people are educated to the point where if anybody wants to use force, we also have a lot of people who are fairly intelligent about what's right and what's wrong. And that's inculcated in us. And I hope it remains for the future. That's my thought.
So shall we move along, sir?
Yes. Yeah, so if anyone wants to file a habeas petition, Chance will be happy to discuss it with you for the small token consultation fee of $10,000.
Whoa. I wish. My wildest dreams.
So,
I assume these things are far more expensive than that.
Well,
no, I said the consultation fee.
Yeah, $10,000.
Yeah, you could easily spend.
Oh, just the consultation. I see.
You could you could easily spend $100,000 on habeas. I close to did that on mine.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
Money.
Well, all right then. You put this article in here from The Hill, and it says, members of Congress once again introduced a bipartisan resolution declaring April Second Chance Month. Second Chance Month is a time to recognize the challenges faced by people with criminal records and to advocate for meaningful reform. Although the idea of a second chance is celebrated, the reality is that the door to opportunity remains shut for millions of Americans coming out of prison. Without access to stable jobs and financial independence, may end up back behind bars or at least continue to have some kind of involvement with the criminal justice system. This is an article that you put in here from The Hill, by the way. And so, do you agree with that, though?
Yes, I do.
Now, here's the question of all. Do you think it will pass? And I probably should have the laugh track cued.
No, I don't think on this political environment of law and order, maximum penalties, I just don't see this passing, but I hope I'm wrong, because things sometimes do pass in amazing political circumstances.
Now, it says the article states each year more than 600,000 people, 600,000 people are released from state and federal prison. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, about two-thirds of those released will be rearrested within 3 years. One of the main contributors to this staggering recidivism rate is the inability to find meaningful employment. It sure seems that we should be more focused on reentry than it costs a crap ton of money to lock somebody up year after year, that if we put, I don't know, a tenth of that into helping them reacclimate into society, then we would have a better return on investment.
Well, I've always posed that question before I get to the script here. I've always wondered if it costs us $50,000 a year and in high cost states like California, New York, and the Federal Bureau of Prison, that's not an unrealistic number, that it costs $40,000 to $50,000 a year. I've always wondered if we paid people $35,000 a year to stay crime free, if we would actually save money. The people who claim to be fiscal responsible and such good stewards of our resources, it seems like they'd get on board with that if we could cut the cost by one third by just simply giving people a stipend not to break the law. But anyway, I do agree with that. A study from the PRISM Policy Initiative found that the unemployment rate for formerly incarcerated individuals is nearly five times higher than the general population. Now, let's go through that. With unemployment rate at roughly 5%, a little bit less, but four in the low 4%, to think that it's 20%, one in five of the prison population can't find a job. For black men with criminal records, the rate is even higher. It comes down to the fact that most employers do conduct background checks. Even a quick internet search often reveals a past record, even if the offense is nonviolent and occurred many years ago.
Now, it seems logical to me that with limited employment opportunities, financial stability becomes unattainable, and the likelihood of reoffending would increase. I mean, like, if you're pretty hungry on a Sunday morning and you're like, I don't have any food in the cupboard, I think I'll go knock over the 7-Eleven. I've got some food. Oh, crap, I'm back in prison. But I needed a soup, man.
So, well, but now see, you're overdoing that. Now, all you've got to do when you're hungry is you just knock on a restaurant's door in the private sector. You say, I'm hungry, and they will warmly welcome you in. And they will serve you as if you were the king. And but anyway, I agree with you. As the article states, if we are serious about reducing recidivism and supporting successful reentry, we should work to dismantle the system of barriers that prevent people with criminal records from rebuilding their lives. And the next one is for you, although somebody didn't put it there.
Did the article have any recommendations on what we should do instead?
It actually did. It said we should expunge criminal records from internet search results. In the United States, if someone goes bankrupt, there's no searchable evidence of that bankruptcy after 10 years. However, if you make a mistake with something as simple as failure to appear in court or a charge of driving under the influence, your record appears on internet searches virtually in perpetuity. These search engine results undermine even the most well-intentioned and best-prepared job applicants. This goes directly against basic American ideal that everyone deserves a second chance. Now, we pay a lot of lip service to that in the United States. A sensible reform would involve requiring search engines and third-party data aggregators to remove criminal records from search results after a designated period, particularly for nonviolent offenses. I think it should go beyond that, but this is what the article's opinion is. If Google can tweak its algorithms to demote low-quality content in search results in an effort to combat fake news, it can give people who have been incarcerated a way to expunge their online record after a period of time through some fair process, helping individuals move on with their lives without the past defining their future.
I'm going to extend that a little bit, that the European countries have made it a big deal about the right to be forgotten. And particularly a country like Germany that has significantly higher privacy standards than what we do, that you can petition to be removed from a Google search for something that is either wrong. I don't know if they let you do it for something that's old, like 10 or 20 years, but you have the right to be forgotten that we do not have here in this fine United States. But Google could do it if they chose to. But Larry, isn't that the big bad government telling Google what they should and shouldn't do with their commercial entity?
Well, that does present some problem because we are a free and open society and we do guarantee access to records. So it's going to require us to rethink, you know, the openness that we envisioned, the founding fathers would have envisioned, and my colleagues when I was working in the Lincoln administration. We would not have foreseen the evolving to where we are today with technological advances.
I do like those suggestions. Did they suggest anything else?
They did. They said we should provide tax credits to employers to hire individuals with criminal records. Financial incentives can be a powerful tool in encouraging businesses to do this. A federal tax credit program specifically designed for employers who hire formerly incarcerated individuals would reduce perceived risk and encourage companies to make these hires. Now, I'm not so sure how it would reduce the perceived risk, but it would certainly encourage them to make the hires because it cuts the expense of hiring them if you're going to get a tax break for it.
Isn't there already something about this? I remember when I was getting released that there's some kind of tax credit. Maybe that's only a Georgia thing that does that?
I think that we have tax incentives for hiring disadvantaged people, but the complexity on how they expire, you know, we always have expiration dates on things in the tax code, so it may be that some of that stuff needs to be revisited.
So I think that, though, that deserves some consideration. And then what else?
Well, they say we should support entrepreneurship for people with criminal records. And they make the point that not every citizen returned to life on the outside will find traditional employment opportunities. But entrepreneurship provides an alternative path. Starting a small business allows individuals to take control of their financial future and contribute positively to their communities. The article also pointed out that unlike corporate hiring managers, customers rarely ask small business owners about their criminal backgrounds. And that seems consistent with my life experience. If you're working for yourself, they don't come in and say, well, I would have hired your business, but I want to know a little bit about you. They care about the quality of the product and service, and entrepreneurship training programs and mentorship initiatives can help people with criminal records build sustainable businesses, which will support them and their families.
And from there, outside of the people whose ancestors are from Africa, in America, all of our ancestors started anew and got a second chance. In this way, second chance is not a concept. It's central to what we are all about. Today, we are not living up to this basic principle.
I kind of think that that's an irony in that statement because so many Americans that are here, their ancestors had criminal records. They had escaped from insane asylums. They were not wanted in the countries. They were oppressed in their countries. And yet they've forgotten all that. And they look down their high, mighty nose about people who want to do exactly what their ancestors did, which was to come here. And people came here without going through processes. They just showed up. They showed up at Ellis Island, among many places, and they just showed up and they were admitted. So I do agree with that, that we've gotten away from living up to that basic principle that America is supposed to stand for.
The author of the article, Brian Hamilton, is a nationally recognized entrepreneur and the chairman of LiveSwitch. He is the founder of Inmates to Entrepreneurs, where he serves as the leading voice on the power of ownership to transform lives. He's well known for being the founder of SageWorks, now Abrigo, the country's first fintech company. He is also the star of Free Enterprise, an award-winning show on ABC based on Inmates to Entrepreneurs.
What on earth is fintech?
Finance tech. It's the people with the PhDs in math and computer science that are making all the algorithms that buy and sell stocks, which is why probably no one should do it on their own because the computers can think faster than you can.
I see. Maybe that's why I've lost so much money in the last 10 years.
At least maybe in the last year, right? In the last 6 months?
Well, I've lost a lot in the last 6 months, but I figure over the last several years I've could have done a whole lot better if I'd listened to the computer.
All right, well then, over at the AP, which is, by golly, the most unreliable source of information out there. So this article is from New York, and it says, New York is set to lower the minimum hiring age for prison guards from 21 to 18. Man, they should do that for alcohol too, don't you think? Seeking to boost the rank of correction officers during a shortage that was exacerbated by the firing of more than 2,000 guards after a week-long strike crippled the state's prison system. State lawmakers approved the measure on Wednesday, and Governor Kathy Hochul, is that right? Hochul or Hochul?
Hochul.
Hochul. And she is a Democrat, is expected to sign it into law. Do you think this is a good idea? This sounds like a bad idea.
Absolutely not. A person at the tender age of 18 is not mature enough in most instances to handle a job that entails so much responsibility. But it does illuminate the chronic labor shortage we have in the United States that we have so many people who refuse to acknowledge that we just don't have enough.
Wait, we have a shortage of labor? Like, this is like the supply of labor, not the job side, right?
Yes, we have the supply of laborers are not sufficient to fulfill the jobs that we have with millions of them unfilled. And we cannot fill the jobs. This illuminates how chronic the labor shortage is. You can't get a job. You can't hire thousands of correction workers. And the salaries are pretty darn good in New York. I mean, I can't speak for the cost of living through the entire state, but the salaries in New York are pretty good in state. The government benefits are pretty good, but you just can't find workers. Now, that should illuminate to people that are amenable to looking at it that we have a labor shortage.
I would, in my experience, prisons aren't exactly in downtown. And I say that knowing that Rikers is, isn't it right there almost downtown?
I'm not sure.
Rikers Island is pretty, I believe it is. He's not listening. I believe it's right in the vicinity. Anyway, the company I work for, they're way out in the boonies of New York, and the cost of living there is cheap. Like, houses are like $70,000 for a 1500 or something square foot house. It's not an expensive place to live, I promise.
So,
I think, though, that some of your concerns have been addressed in the bill. It states that the bill establishes some rules for the younger guards, including policies that they cannot obtain or use firearms or transport inmates outside of the prisons. They also must be supervised when performing contact roles with inmates during the first year and a half of the job. Now, does that help assuage your opposition?
No, not really. We need to look at the underlying problems. The article states, the push for the lower age for corrections officers came after guards walked off the job in February while striking to protest poor working conditions. Not salary, conditions. Hochul was forced to deploy the State National Guard to prisons to maintain operations during the strike. So it got so bad that she had to call the National Guard to run the prisons. The governor ended up firing more than 2,000 guards who refused to return to work after the state and the guards union reached a deal to end the walkout, which lasted around 3 weeks. Hochul has barred the guards who were fired from holding other state jobs in the future. So my question is, have they addressed the problems? This sounds like the National Air Traffic Control strike in 1981 when the controllers walked off the job and we had a president named Reagan and he fired all the controllers. This sounds very reminiscent to me in terms of how it was handled.
Now, I don't know if they solved it. The article states that the strike came after the high-profile fatal beating of Robert Brooks at an upstate New York prison in December, which was recorded on the guards' body cameras and led to charges against more than a dozen people. Another incarcerated person, oh boy, Messiah Nantwi, died on March 1st after being injured in a series of beatings by guards, according to an indictment. 10 guards were charged over Nantwi's, I deeply apologize if I've butchered that pronunciation, I deeply apologize, and including two who were charged with, call it, murder.
Now, what boggles my mind, because I would expect something like this to happen in Alabama, but I'm an equal opportunity basher. And if this is happening in a progressive state like New York, I want to know what the hell's going on there. This is not the backwoods that we're talking about. This is Alabama, Mississippi type of behavior. You've got guards beating up inmates and killing them to the point of death. What kind of joint are you running there?
One where you got a good shot at dying.
So the article mentions that some states, including Florida, Maine, and New Jersey, allow 18-year-olds to become corrections officers. That still doesn't make it right, but they're dealing with the reality of they can't fill the jobs.
Yep. Yeah, I can't imagine my kid who's just turned 18. I cannot even imagine him being in that kind of environment. I can't imagine me being in that environment, but not him, for sure.
It's a challenging environment, and you have to have really good judgment.
Sure.
And you have to be open to learning things and keeping them in mind 24/7. I don't know if it's possible for an 18-year-old to do that.
I'm sure there are some that are witty enough, collected enough upstairs, physically imposing enough to not be, oh my God, just the amount of street smarts. You're going to get gamed all the time.
Well, you know, prison is a challenging place, and it's full of people just like that behind the bars. So I have no idea how an 18-year-old would fare. Most guards starting out don't fare very good either. I think it takes years to develop the type of mentality you need to actually operate efficiently under those conditions.
Yep, absolutely. What else, Larry? Are we done?
Well, I just wanted to ask Chance, did you get a chance to listen to any of our episodes or review them? Because I got some pushback about the federal versus state plea process, episode 338. Did you peer in at any of that?
I did, and I listened to that, and I thought you did very, very, very well. Where do you think you fell down?
The listener said that I just was not clear enough on why, you know, the distinctions. I made a big to-do about how that it was a lot less structure in state court and how we make deals at the last minute, including the deals that the judge has never seen until that day, and then the judge signs off on them. But what in particular, if you had to name two or three things, makes federal court so different? And you do practice in federal court, right?
I do both federal and state. But if you want to know what I think, this is what I think, is that there's a lot less flex in terms of working out things in the federal system than there is in the state. And the state allows not only flexibility, but, you know, it doesn't really put time constraints on all this, and you don't have to commit all of this to paper and run it through a mainframe over and over and over. And there's not too many cooks stirring the pot. If you think about it, in the federal system, you've got the assistant to U.S. attorney, you've got probation officers, you've got all kinds of input, depending on what the case is, from different directions, and ultimately a judge who's tied to a grid and who has the last word. And everything has to be committed to paper, and everything has to relate to the other. So you can't deviate far from the foundational facts that led you to that plea to begin with. Whereas in state court, you've got a great deal of flexibility. You're not tied to things you've written and put out because it's just not built that way. A lot of the negotiation is verbal. It's not written. And a lot of it is between the defense attorney and, say, the prosecutor who's been assigned to the case. And whatever's worked out there is usually honored by the judge. In a federal system, you can do all that work and you can make a pro offer and you commit all this stuff to writings and you run it through the mainframe. And if the judge doesn't like it, you're still back where you started, and sometimes south, way south. So the intensity, the regiment, the formality of federal court makes it a much more labor intense and less satisfactory way of resolving a criminal case than, say, the state.
So, in my years of supporting attorneys, when we're in state court, on a day that they're doing plead outs, they'll have a zoo doc. It'll be 20 people scheduled on a Friday afternoon or a Wednesday afternoon. And they're working deals all the way up till the time that the case is called. And sometimes the case is called and that the defense attorney says, "Your Honor, we're still working." And they got on the call somebody else's case. Mm-hmm. And the offer has been presented to the defendant, who's sometimes pressured heavily to sign the offer because it's not going to get any better, allegedly. And they hand it to the judge, and the judge looks at it and says, "It's okay by me." The judge sees that case going off of his or her docket. Doesn't work that way in federal court, right?
Oh, yeah.
You try to hand something up to the judge that you worked out right there on the spot. What's the judge going to do in federal court?
Yeah, kick it back. I mean, no, you have to, things have to be worked out in a methodical way, and they have to be committed to writing, and they have to be shared by all involved. And, you know, it's a process, you know, in the state court, even if you're in trial, you know, on a break, even after you've selected a jury, you can still work out something, dismiss the jury, and work out, you know, or have your disposition, your settlement, without going much further. There's a whole lot to do with judges and state courts. There's a presiding judge. There are other judges. There's case management. It's all about moving your cases, disposing your cases, and being efficient. In federal court, you got a federal judge. That's it. And it's very, very, very difficult to deal one-on-one with that without really understanding the system and without understanding how each thing falls into place and how you have to present it and what moves you've got to make. It is a tremendous burden to work out things in the federal system.
Well, I'm using slang that's really not appropriate when I say a zoo docket. That's not what it's called. It's, you know, it's actually when the discovery process and the preliminary things related to a case have been gone through, then you get to a stage where we have docket call, and the judge wants to know, is this case going to trial or going to be resolved? So on docket call, what do they call that similar process in California? In Arkansas, I think it's the omnibus hearing. But anyway, at docket call, the judge...
The
judge
here
is handed plea agreements that he or she has never seen, never even thought about. And they almost always accept them because it moves the system.
Well, it moves the system and, you know, disposes of cases. And, you know, the whole thing about state court is it moves so slowly because it's so cluttered. And so good case management is appreciated. And that starts the moment you're, you know, the DA's assigned the case and you've got a defense attorney who may have analyzed it and you've got a client who may be disposed to settling it. And, you know, early disposition sometimes it works out incredibly well. And that can start just with a phone call before the whole thing starts rolling, even before arraignment. So you've got a lot of flexibility.
Well, let me pull one more surprise on you that I didn't even contemplate. Here, there are judges that will lean on the state and the defense attorney to come to an agreement. And I suppose it's not too improper to talk about the late judge, Pat Murdoch, but he would tell both attorneys, he would tell the state what was wrong with their case and why they should make a deal. And he would tell the defense attorney what was wrong with their defense and why they should make a deal. You know, he'd tell in a domestic violence, Murdoch would say, counselor, your client is 6'3". She's 5'1" and 100 pounds. The jury's not going to believe you, your defense, you know, that she was the aggressor. And in turn, they had to lean on the state the same way to say, state, you need to take this into consideration. Do your judges do that out there?
Well, they, you know, on occasion, and this is interesting you should bring it up, because, you know, as a criminal defense attorney, I used to conduct these conversations with my counterpart, the people or the deputy district attorney, you know, at a time before actually pre-trial and sometimes before arraignment. I mean, if we got the opportunity. Today, it's a little bit different. Sometimes you get into situations where either city attorneys or district attorneys don't want to discuss the case. They're too busy to discuss the case. They don't know how to discuss the case. And so I have found that if you do motions in limine, you work out these motions and it educates the judge before everything gets started in the trial as to exactly what you're discussing, what the strengths and weaknesses of both sides are, depending on the issues you bring up in limine before you get started with the trial. And that could cause a judge, and I've had it happen now more than just once, to say, hey, you guys come in the back, let's talk about this thing and twist a few arms and get a deal going. So yeah, it happens. So,
well, I appreciate you going through that episode and hopefully people were able to benefit from it and understand that the plea process is not as bad as it's vilified to be. It serves a useful purpose. Is it perfect though? Do people get railroaded and stampeded and doing pleas? Sometimes probably do. But most of the time, it's to the defendant's benefit because they're facing such horrendous exposure if they don't take proactive measures to limit that exposure.
That's true. And, you know, you've got to know where you stand, and you got to have a good idea of where things go from where you're at. That takes some good advice, and it takes some, you know, good judgment, and it takes some effort.
So, well, I don't have any more on the plea episode. Did you have anything that you want to ask about the plea before we shut down?
I don't, no.
I know you love pleas. You love that as much as I love summary judgment.
Absolutely. Well, everyone, thank you for joining us this Memorial Day weekend. And if you are one of the Memorial Day a person honoring a person who has fallen due to service. Is that the right way to put that?
That's a good way to put it.
I'm not sure.
Then I hope you have a wonderful weekend. And head over to registrymatters.co for show notes. And you can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Old-fashioned voicemail, if you want to talk to Larry, is 747-227-4477. I know I say that fast, but you can repeat it and slow it down. Read the transcript. It'll be in there. Head over to patreon.com/registrymatters to become a patron for as little as a dollar a month, and every little dollar helps. Appreciate it so very much. And without anything else, I hope you gentlemen have a fine, outstanding weekend.
Thank you much. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate that.
Thank you. And see you in a week. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.